everybody. I'm Beattie Confredos, and welcome, welcome, welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. And of course, the reality is that we all need help, various different kinds of help at different times in our life. And just before the show began today, I was thinking, this is the 339th Ask Beattie Show that I've been doing here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's really amazing how quickly the time has gone. And thousands, I mean, a couple of hundred thousand people have downloaded the show in the archives. And I know that, you know, thousands of people listen to this show worldwide. And I wonder, I really wonder, what's the impact of listening to the Ask Beattie Show has been on your personal life, on your professional life? Because every single week, I am trying to motivate and inspire you and convince you that we do not need to navigate life's challenges on our own. And for the last couple of years, I've been citing depression statistics, for example, and the number that I have been talking about has been 16 million adults in the United States. So just before the show, I was just checking to see whether or not that number has changed. And yes, it has. And that number has actually gone up. And statistically, we are looking at 17.3 million adults in the United States that are suffering from clinical depression. And that actually translates into 7.1% of all adults. And for adult females, that number is 8.7%. And if we're looking at anxiety disorders, including panic attacks of various different kinds, we're looking at a number of 40 million people. So people are really, really struggling. And what we're seeing is that the prevalence of major depression, and this is the number that really concerns me as a mom, has been going up significantly, with adolescents. And for example, an estimated 3.2 million adolescents aged 12 to 17 in the United States had at least one major depressive episode. And this number, just listen to this, this represents 13.3% of the US population age 12 to 17. And the prevalence of major depressive episode was higher among adolescent females. That's 20% compared to males, 6.8%. Of course, we don't know whether or not that number is actually reliable, because I think at this point, women and young girls are still more likely to reach out and ask for help than the male counterparts. So, you know, my hope is that whether or not you're struggling in your relationships, and we all struggle in our relationships from time to time, and nobody is immune from having issues, in their life, that you really do give yourself permission when things get tough to reach out and ask for help. And of course, we're still dealing with the impact of the coronavirus. Of course, things are easing up, and that is a good thing. And here in New York City, as I'm walking around the streets, people are still wearing masks, and people are still maintaining, for the most part, appropriate social distance, which is what the experts are recommending. But 52% of those working remotely are still feeling really anxious and really hoping and wondering when we're going to be getting back to a more normal way of life. And of course, people are still concerned about jobs, about health, about their mental health, about moving. I hear a lot of people wondering, you know, maybe I should move. Maybe I should start a new career. Maybe the pandemic has given us some time to really reevaluate our lives and reset. And of course, now that it is spring and the weather is definitely getting warmer and warmer around the country, hopefully people are going to be exercising more and eating less and getting out and finding ways that they can connect, really connect with other human beings, and not just on Zoom and not just on Skype. I mean, when I think about it, in my old world and in my private practice here in New York City and in East Hampton, I haven't seen a live patient other than on a screen since last March. Yes, we have compensated and we have done the very best that we can do. But the truth is that it is really not the same. And I'm looking forward within a very, very short period of time of having people being able to reconnect in person and come to my offices. You know, there was an interesting piece written by Gina Belafonte in the New York Times. And the article was Parts of COVID Life We Might Just Want to Keep. So I ask you the question, does any of this resonate with you? Number one, you know, Gina asks us, has it really forced us? And I think the answer is yes, to reevaluate how and with whom we want to live our lives. What changes would we like to make? And of course, I'm always, always asking the question, you know, lessons to be learned. What lessons have we learned from a variety of different situations in our lives, including COVID? And I think for many, it has really shifted our priorities and brought a new kind of enlightenment. And I'm always really, really curious to hear what the shift in priorities has been for you, my audience and my patients, and what kind of new enlightenment, you know, have you been able to find for yourself? And of course, there's been a lot less commuting, more time for self and families. And of course, sometimes it just became too much where you just need to take a walk, go into another room, and where all of this togetherness really, really, for many, many people, for all of us, became an over-the-top phenomenon at different times in the last year. But also, you know, we were able to connect with friends and family anywhere in the world without leaving our home. So that has been a real plus. I mean, prior to last March, I would say that I spent personally and certainly professionally almost no time on the computer. And I was always encouraging people to spend less time with social media and get out and connect face to face and exercise and do a lot of other things that are in their best interest. But of course, the reality is that the computer and the Zoom and the Skype, it really saved us. I mean, it was really the way that the majority of people were really able to connect. But other things that I think people have started to ponder, and I know that I certainly have, you know, questions like, who do I really want to spend time with in person? And I have to tell you that my list is actually, it's a very, very short list over and above seeing my patients. Of course, my husband, I see him all the time. And I'd certainly like to spend a lot more time with my daughter who lives in Hudson. So that's a 2.5 hour train ride or car ride from New York City. But I've also started to wonder, and I think we probably all have, you know, what events do I really want to attend? And I think that for all of us, there has been a reset, and I am always interested and I am always curious to hear from you what your reset has been. And by the way, the call-in number is 888-874-4888.
However, as Gina Belafonte pointed out, that for many people, there has been a double burden. And that means that many, many people do not have and did not have the options that we are talking about. And these are the people who serve, in quotes, the privilege, the garbage collectors, the transit workers, the wait staff, the first responders, the doctors and the nurses. And I hope that all of us are really, really, really so appreciative and that we have not failed to let these people know how appreciative we are of what they have been able to do for us to keep things going during a very, very challenging time. And for these people, there's been an increase in family pressure and more stress and less family time, and of course, continued concern about the virus. And this is why, you know, every single week I have a number of tips. And of course, for people who've been listening to the show, they probably are saying to themselves, okay, Beanie, enough already. We really, really get it. But I think that the tips are tips that we all need to not only think about, but that we really need to incorporate into our lives. And of course, Dr. Gary Null, he gives us these tips every single day as well. And some of the tips include the plant-based diets, the fruits and the vegetables and the grains and the fish and the nuts, and making sure that we are eating healthily and interacting and socializing, and that of course we get enough sleep, 8 hours a night, and if we need to take naps, because you know I'm always looking at, you know, different statistics and how people around the world are living. And for example, people in Sardinia, they live the longest. So I was very curious a number of years ago to find out, so what is it that they are doing that we may not be doing? And of course, their diet and their socialization, and they even nap in the middle of the afternoon. So other reminders, and of course, we can make all kinds of excuses why we can't exercise, but exercise and weight training, I mean, that has kept me sane during the past year, actually for my entire life. And yoga and meditation and massage and taking a bath and making sure. And this is where this last year may be really, really helpful for people, to making sure that we have supportive people in our life, and that we are conscious and mindful of eliminating toxins. Okay, eliminating chemical toxins. And of course, when I talk about toxins, I talk about chemical toxins, but mostly I talk about the importance of eliminating toxic people. And that sometimes means friends and family. And if you're feeling stressed, you know, other things you can do is positive visualization. Just imagine and visualize something wonderful and positive and fun that will hopefully help to put you in a really good mood. And also things like dancing and music and aromatherapy. And of course, what I found during some of the most challenging times in my own life is that helping others and giving back, it is such an important phenomenon. And I've always felt that I have gotten so much more in the giving, and it has made a tremendous difference in my own life. So maybe it's time to think about doing some volunteer work. And also, you know, something else that I've been noticing statistically is that more and more people are getting dogs. And of course, we love Cha-Cha. Cha-Cha is our therapy dog. And very frequently when my patients would come to our apartment, and that's where my office is, Cha-Cha would greet the people at the door. And no matter how depressed or anxious somebody was feeling, she was always able to put a smile on everybody's face. And, you know, don't poo-poo the idea of support groups. You know, the 12-step programs can be very, very helpful for some. And remember, of course, to eliminate the sugar and the soda and the alcohol and the nicotine, and to try to find ways, and this is a challenge for all of us, to find a balance between work and fun. But if you find that your depression is not lifting, you've tried all of these tips and you're exercising and you're trying to connect, but that your depression is still not lifting, give yourself permission, you know, to reach out and ask for some professional help. Well, for this next segment of the Ask Beaty Show, we are going to be talking about suicide, and I'm going to introduce my guest, Joanne Hartpole, in just a moment. But I want to give you some statistics here before we begin a very, very important conversation. And you may not know this, especially if you have been fortunate enough to not have ever been touched by suicide in your life. Suicide is a major, it is not a minor, it is a major public health concern and is among the leading cause of death in the United States. And you may not know, but in the USA, suicide is the leading, it's the second leading cause of death among children and adolescents ages 10 to 24. So we've got to be really mindful as professionals and parents about what is going on and not going on in terms of mood with our children and our adolescents. And the third leading cause of death amongst 12-year-olds. And in 2019, the suicide rates were highest among adults ages 45 to 54 and 55 to 64, with the highest rate amongst adults age 85 years or older. And the total suicide rate in the United States increased 35% from 1999 to 2018. Nearly one of every eight children between 5 and 12. It's like, oh my God, what is going on with a five-year-old that is having these thoughts, has suicidal thoughts, and teen suicide rates are rising. Suicide is the second most frequent cause of death amongst teens. Suicide attempts by young people have actually quadrupled over a six-year period. And since 2011, there has been an increase nationally by self-poisoning by young people. And suicide among people ages 10 to 24 increased by 56%. However, there is some good news, and I always like to share good news. And this is according to the CDC. The USA had 2,677 fewer suicide deaths in 2020 than in 2019, translating into a 5.6 decline, which is great. We want to see a greater decline, but any decline is good. But found that 40.9% of participants has reported at least one mental health issue, including depression, anxiety, or trauma-related disorders, and that there has been greater use of substances. But typically, the focus when we talk about suicide is on the person who killed him or herself, and rarely, certainly not in my circles, do people discuss the aftermath and tragedy of what the person's family and friends are having to deal with. Questions like, could I have known? Could I have done more? Is it somehow my fault? How could I have missed the sign or signs? Of course, sometimes there are no specific signs. Could I have been a better mother or father or brother or lover or spouse? Well, my guest today is Joanne Hartpole, and she is the president of Coping After Suicide. And Joanne, I am so, so grateful that you have agreed to come on the Ask Beaty Show today. And I just want to say a little bit more about you before we start our conversation, that Joanne is an international authority on suicide, bereavement, and postvention response, with over 20 years of experience addressing the questions, emotions, and fears that arise in the aftermath of suicide. She is certified in thanatology, that's death, dying, and bereavement, and has done deep, transformative, life-changing work. working directly with grieving individuals and couples and families, and facilitating numerous national and international suicide bereavement support groups, advising schools and colleges and universities and workplaces and faith communities, educating mental health clinicians like myself, and providing the media with insight and perspective into the unique nature of suicide loss. And unfortunately, Joanne lost her brother Stephen to suicide in 1993. So Joanne, was that the beginning of your involvement in helping people and educating people on the aftermath of suicide?
It absolutely was. I at the time my brother died, I was a practicing lawyer. I was with a big law firm in New York City, and my brother had no prior mental health problems of any kind until in his mid-20s, he very suddenly developed bipolar disorder, which I now know, I didn't know anything about it then, but I came to understand that it could be an adult onset illness, and that's what happened in his case. And from the time he was first diagnosed until the time he took his own life was less than a year, even though we tried very hard to get him the help that he needed. And so I ended up making a pretty significant reassessment of what I wanted my life to include, and ended up leaving law practice and devoting my entire professional world to helping families and communities cope with the aftermath of suicide.
Was his suicide, and of course, I mean, suicide is always a shock. I mean, was it something that came for your family completely out of the blue? And was he in treatment with anybody, you know, during the time that he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
He was in treatment. He had been hospitalized. He was being treated over the course of that year by several different very well-trained and competent mental health professionals, but we ran out of time, and we believe that he stopped taking the medication that he was prescribed and ended up taking his life. It was shocking, but it was not altogether surprising, I think I'd say. He had made one prior suicide attempt, so we certainly knew that he was at high risk.
Mm-hmm. How did the family, I mean, how did you all react to the fact that, you know, your brother, the family's the son, you know, was at such a place in his life where he no longer felt the desire to live? I mean, the impact on you and on your family, I can't even imagine, you know, what you must have gone through. How did you deal with all of this emotionally?
Yeah, it was incredibly profound. I mean, this was a young man. He was 26 years old. He had been an honors graduate of Yale. He'd gone to Harvard Law School. He was married to his college sweetheart. He had just a stellar, accomplished life. He was incredibly popular. He had many friends. And so this was not someone who you ever would have imagined. You know, you often hear, oh, he was the last one you'd expect. Well, he was the last one you'd expect. And so a huge part of what my family was dealing with was just incredible grief and loss, bewilderment, trying to make sense out of how this had happened, trying to fit it into the narrative of who we understood him to be and how we understood our family. It was extremely confronting, extremely complex.
Mm-hmm. So you changed your professional life 360 degrees. And I really want my audience, I mean, you've done so much. And of course, I went online, Joanne, and I found out, you know, all kinds of amazing things that you've been doing over the years. But specifically, you know, what are you doing in terms of helping individuals and families and communities, you know, right now deal with and try to heal from the trauma of someone they love who has committed suicide?
So I am not a therapist. I'm not a clinician. And so I'm not treating people for anything. But what I'm doing, because I've been in this field for so long, and of course I went through it personally, I can help individuals and families do several things. First of all, I can help them make sense out of it. I can help them understand what we know from the research about what can lead to suicide. I can help normalize what their experience is. I can help them strategize about, for example, what do we say to the children in the family? How do we explain suicide to right. children? Do we tell the truth to people in the community? How do we preserve someone's legacy in the aftermath of suicide? How do we deal with different family members who may be coping in very, very different ways? Often a suicide, you'd like to believe that it brings family members together, and certainly it can in some cases, but it often can lead to a lot of complexity and blame and recrimination and anger and feeling abandoned and alone. And so a lot of what I do is help individuals and families understand what they're going through and why, and give them some strategies for coping with it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the fact that you've been there and that you're not just talking, you know, theoretically, certainly must make all the difference in the world in terms of people really being able to, you know, understand and hear what you're saying as a result of what you've been through.
Exactly right. You know, I have spent 2 decades learning the research and coming to really understand the issue in an intellectual and academic way. And then I bring that and combine it and blend it with my personal experience. And then I take both of those and blend it with 20 years of working with thousands of other people who've lost someone to suicide. And so I try to give my clients and group members the benefit of the totality of that experience and help them feel heard and understood and seen and give them hope that they can get through this and that they can start to feel like themselves again, that they can get to a place where they start to recognize themselves again.
What are some of the latest findings in the research? Are we learning anything new? I mean, I have to, you know, I was thinking over the last, I've been practicing now as a psychotherapist and sex therapist, Joanne, for almost, you know, every time I say it, I can hardly believe it, but it's almost, you know, 40 years. And I've been very fortunate as a clinician. There hasn't been one suicide in my practice. But what are some of the latest findings that we are reading about and hearing about in current research?
So for many, many, many years, the way we looked at suicide, which is still to a great extent the way we look at suicide even now, was based on mental illness. And what we know from many decades of psychological autopsy studies is that more than 90% of people who take their own life have a diagnosable mental health condition at the time of their death. Most commonly, it's depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, substance abuse, or some combination. And that underlying vulnerability that's attributable to a serious mental health condition, it forms a sort of baseline. And then there's, on top of that, layered a combination of factors resulting from the person's individual history, in some cases going all the way back to childhood, in some cases including current events that are going on in their life. And so that it's this very individualized stew of factors, this perfect storm of factors in each person's case, but that the underpinning of it lay in the realm of mental illness. And although that's true in many, many, many cases, it was not actually resulting in moving the needle in terms of preventing suicide. And so the biggest shift in the research over the past number of years has been looking less at the sort of overall description of suicidality and looking much more at what we call the ideation to action mechanism. What takes an individual person from suicidal ideation, in other words, about suicide, to acting on it? What is the mechanism whereby an individual goes from ideation to action? And what we're discovering through looking at it through that lens, not specifically by reference to mental illness, but instead looking at this mechanism, is that the factors that seem most operative are, first of all, excruciating psychological pain and suffering, combined with what the field is coming to refer to as frantic hopelessness, these ruminating, repetitive thoughts over and over that the person has internally. It's a subjective feeling of hopelessness, a sense that they are never going to feel any better than they do right now, and a frantic feeling that they need to act on it right now. And that combination of the psychological pain and suffering and the frantic hopelessness produces what we refer to as cognitive constriction, which is just a fancy term for tunnel vision, this very narrowed, distorted way of looking out into the future, not seeing options, not seeing hope, not seeing possibility, not believing that help will help, and an overriding urgency to make the pain stop. And when you take that backdrop and you combine it with access to lethal means, that is when people are at high risk for suicide. And what we're learning is that when someone goes from ideation to action, when they hit that point of urgency, that the window between that feeling of urgency and actually acting on their suicidality is much shorter than we realize. In most people, overwhelming, it's less than a workday. And in many, many people, it's an hour or two. And so we're starting to look at this mechanism of suicidality in a very different way than just as an outcome of depression or other kinds of mental illnesses.
No, it's very interesting. And I'm wondering, too, does the research, if there have been findings, whether or not the majority or what percentage of people who actually do commit suicide, whether or not they have been in treatment or not during the time when they made the decision to end their lives?
So it's interesting because what we're discovering is that even the most competent, most highly trained, most experienced clinicians who are used to dealing with suicidal people, even they will say that their ability to predict suicide is about 50-50. And that even those who were in treatment and who were asked directly by their clinician whether they were thinking of taking their own life didn't always answer in the affirmative. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they were lying to their clinician.
Right.
In some cases, it may be aspirational that they're trying so hard not to give in to their own feeling of suicidality that they don't want to admit it even to themselves. Sometimes it's that they are not feeling acutely suicidal in the moment that the question's being asked, but that they go on then to become more acutely suicidal afterwards. So it's not about just being in treatment. It's really that we need to get much better tools to be able to identify people who are at acute imminent risk of suicide. And there just is not yet consensus within the field even about what we mean when we use the term imminent risk. So a lot of the focus is on just understanding much better how an individual gets to that point of desperation.
You know, I know that in my own practice, as I say, you know, it's been fortunate that there hasn't been anybody that's committed suicide, but that there are people that I've seen and that there are people who I currently see who I talk to every day. People who, you know, I'll ask the question, are you suicidal? You know, how bad is the depression today? But I have a sense with, and of course not all therapists would do this or would want to do this, but that there's something in intuitive that tells me, even if it's a 5 minute, let's touch base for 5 minutes every day until things seem to settle a bit, that's something that I have found to be helpful. And maybe, I don't know whether or not that would be a tool that, you know, we would want to be implementing across the board in the mental health field. But, I sometimes wonder, especially as I was preparing, you know, to speak with you today, Joanne, whether or not maybe that is something that, and that's not to blame therapists, that in certain situations we ought to be doing as therapists. You know, if we have that gut feeling that this is not good. This session has not gone well, and I'm worried about you, that perhaps the touching base once a day, even if it's just for a short period of time, it could really make all the difference in the world. What do you think about that? And what would the literature say about that kind of an idea or tool?
So certainly we know that connectedness can be a protective factor. And whether that's connectedness with a trusted mental health professional, connectedness with family, with community, with a sense of meaning and purpose in someone's life, we certainly know that connectedness matters. The challenge is that the connectedness matters until it doesn't. And so there just are not reliable enough tools to be able to know with certainty that any particular method will guarantee that you'll be able to identify someone at risk any more than we can guarantee that we could identify someone at risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. We know the risk factors, but we just don't have the precision to know with certainty. And there is a very high false negative rate with people assuring their clinicians that they are not suicidal and then going on to take their lives. So it certainly sounds like it's been meaningful in your practice, and it could have value without question. But the research shows that the more we are able to move away from the subjective reporting on the part of the patient or client about their own suicidality and are able to move in the direction of identifying more objective forms of information gathering, ultimately we will be better off.
Mm-hmm. No, perhaps. We've just been lucky. But what are some of the warning signs that people may not be aware of or may not be able to even identify as warning signs that we should all be on the outlook for if we have concerns about a loved one or a friend, a family member, even a colleague? What should we be looking for more than perhaps we do or we have?
So what the first thing to keep in mind is that often there people don't show signs, and there are lots of reasons for this. So it's not necessarily the case that the signs are there, and if we just look more carefully, we will see them. In some cases, there simply aren't signs, or there are signs that make sense only in retrospect. Uh-huh. Having said that, here are some things to pay attention to. You want to notice if someone's behavior is changing significantly from what's typical for them. So someone who is eating much more or much less than is typical for them. Someone who's sleeping much more or much less than is typical for them. Someone who is withdrawing from activities that they typically would be participating in. In the case of a young person, are they going from being a very good student to suddenly their grades are dropping? So the people who are around us, who we know well, if you're noticing a significant change in what's typical for them and that change persists for more than 2 weeks, that's
right.
Something you want to pay attention to.
What should we do? I mean, that defines, and those are the criteria of major depression, that, where it's lasting, 2 weeks or longer. But let's say, somebody's listening right now and they're saying, oh my goodness, my daughter, my son, my friend, my spouse. So what should the people do today? We're noticing that. What should we do?
Got it.
What should they do?
So the first thing to do is trust your instinct. If you're, as a layperson, we are not equipped to make a diagnosis, but we are equipped to listen to that inner voice, that gut level feeling that something's not right. So that's
right.
The first thing is to trust your instinct. The second thing is to know that it is absolutely safe to ask someone a direct question about whether they are feeling suicidal. It is not going to put the idea in their head. It's not going to increase their risk. It is absolutely safe and preferable to ask someone a direct question. And here's how you say it. You say, I want to check in about your safety. Have you had any thoughts about death or dying?
Okay.
So you could say, I've noticed that. And then you fill in the blank with what it is that you've noticed. I noticed that you don't seem to be acting like yourself lately. I noticed that you've been talking a lot about feeling hopeless. I noticed whatever it is that you've noticed. And then say, and I want to check in about your safety. Have you had any thoughts about death or dying? And you want to do it from a place of compassion, and you want to listen to the answer and not panic, and not, you want to stay calm and just listen to what they have to say.
And if the person says, no, I've just been having a hard time and you don't need to worry about me taking my own life, and then, you know, you find in retrospect that it's not that they were lying, that for their own reasons they were not able or not wanting to let you know what was really going on inside.
So it's very complicated, especially when you're dealing with an adult. There are limits to what we can do. And one of the most painful and most confronting aspects of losing someone to suicide is really coming face to face with the truth that we don't have control over other people. We don't have control over what they're thinking and feeling, and we don't have control over what we do, what they do. And so if you ask someone that question and they say, thank you so much for asking me, really, I'm okay, that's another time that you're going to check your instinct. Does what they say to you as they're responding to your question feel credible? And if it feels credible, then you need to accept what they've said. If it doesn't feel credible, you can say, you know, I hear you saying that, but I have to tell you, my gut is concerned. Can we talk a little bit more about how you're handling the situations in your life that are so challenging? I want you to know that I'm here. The other thing you can do is make sure that they're aware of both the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline phone number, which is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-TALK, and also that they're aware of the crisis text line. You can text the word TALK to 741-741 so that you know that you've provided them with some resources. So even if in the moment you're having the conversation with them, they may not be acknowledging suicidality, you've now shared with them resources that they have available if at some point they feel that they need them. So it doesn't all ride on the outcome of that particular conversation with you.
You know, and your comments, you know, it's so true about we can't change anybody. And we can't. The only person we can hopefully change is ourselves. And we can't control anyone. And hopefully, you know, we have enough control, you know, over ourselves. You know, as we're talking, actually, it reminds me of a patient that I was treating in Sarasota, Florida, who I was very concerned about. And I was talking to her every day and we were checking in. And my gut told me that I should involuntarily have her committed and at least, you know, have an involuntary assessment. And that was a very difficult decision. At least her husband went along with the plan. She was furious with me. But fortunately, her husband agreed to take her to the hospital. She was assessed and she was hospitalized. And I think that probably that involuntary commitment probably saved her life. But again, you know, very, very difficult for the layperson and families to really know what to do. You know, when someone is saying no, you know, I'm kind of okay enough, and I'm not suicidal, and you know, lay off, just lay off, and let me be.
It's very complicated because hospitalization certainly in some cases is warranted. There's no question. But often hospitalization can make things worse. Release from the hospital and the time after release from the hospital, whether it was voluntary or involuntary, is an extremely high risk time. Often from the family's perspective, hospitalization feels like a relief because they know that their loved one is safe.
Right.
But actually, whether hospitalization in the bigger picture is value added is a very complex question. And especially for people in certain communities, in certain marginalized communities, the hospitalization itself can be traumatizing, whether it's voluntary or not. And so hospitalization has its place. There's no question about it. But it's a much more nuanced and complicated calculation than most families appreciate. And the other thing is I've worked with so many families who say, you know, if I had only gotten my loved one to the hospital and gotten them admitted to the hospital, maybe they would have survived. But I've worked with just as many families who say, we got our loved one to the hospital and it made things worse, or they killed themselves while they were in the hospital on suicide watch. And so my experience has been, for almost everyone who loses someone to suicide, the belief is, if I had just taken one more step, maybe I could have prevented it. And for those people who took the step of getting their loved one hospitalized, what they say in the aftermath is, if only I hadn't insisted that my loved one go to the hospital, maybe they would have survived. That second guessing and that self-recrimination and the wondering what I did wrong, that is almost universal among survivors of suicide loss, and it exists irrespective of the literal steps they took at the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the statistics that concerns me every single week, you know, when I'm looking at the research, whether we're talking about, you know, depression, anxiety, and certainly suicide, is what is going on in terms of young people in the increase in childhood and young adult suicide. I mean, we're talking kids 5 years old, you know, statistics 10 to 24-year-olds were, let's see here, where, you know, there's been a 40% increase nationally for self-poisoning by young people. The rate, 56% increase with kids ages 10 to 24. I mean, what is your sense, Joanne, about what is going on with that?
I think we need to be really, really careful, because actually what the research is showing is that there had been an incremental increase. There is no epidemic of suicide among young people. It is not rising exponentially, and it is really dangerous to normalize it and message it in a way that sends the message to the young people that suicide among their peers is climbing and growing at some alarming rate. It's actually not. The data for 2019, which is the last year for which there's data, the rate among young people in all age groups went down, not up. And so what we know is that there are serious concerns, of course, especially given the pandemic, but even before that, of course we want to be paying attention to depression and anxiety among young people. It's heartbreaking, and it's important to pay attention to that. But in terms of the actual literal risk of suicide, overwhelmingly, the people that we need to be worried about in our country who are at risk for suicide are middle-aged and older white men. Three-quarters of the suicides in our country are middle-aged and older white men. Is it possible for a young person, an adolescent, or a child even younger than that to take their own life? Tragically, yes, it can happen, but it is so extremely rare. It is so extremely rare. It is not an alarming epidemic increase in suicide among young people. So can it happen? Without question. Do we need to be paying close attention to the mental health of our young people? Absolutely. I'm a parent myself, so I take it very seriously. But I think we want to really be making a distinction between the things that we need to be taking seriously and extrapolating from that there is some acute danger to our young people or a normalization about suicide.
Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you say this because, I mean, some of the numbers that, you know, I have, and I haven't got the sources in front of me, and I'm really careful about reporting. I mean, these were numbers that, you know, that I obtained from, you know, bona fide research.
So, I mean, and I'm going to go back after the show and you know, take a look at some of the sources. So you're saying that, just to be clear, so that, for example, I have a statistic here that that the suicide rate amongst children ages to 24 increased by 56%. So you're saying that that number, and I'm happy to retract that information, but as I said, I got it from a bona fide research site on suicide.
Right.
You're saying that number is not correct.
I'm not great. Well. The question is 56% over what period of time? So for example, the CDC data is that suicide rate among children ages 5 to 14 in 2019 was 1.3 for every 100,000 kids that age. That's the most recent data. The year before for 2018 is 1.5. The year before that, it was 1.3. The numbers are just absolutely tiny. So it is true that, for example, in 2009, it was 0.6. In 2019, it was 1.3. So yes, that's absolutely an increase. It's not that your statistic is wrong. It's just really important to keep it in a larger perspective of what that actually means in terms of what the risk is for kids that
right.
age. So
no,
they can both be
clearly.
True. I guess what
I mean,
I'm saying is that your
news,
number
then.
And our number. Look, any suicide of a young person is heartbreaking and tragic. It's absolutely awful. I run a support group, a national support group for mothers who've lost children to suicide, and to listen to them, it's absolutely heartbreaking. But our young people are not the ones who are overwhelmingly at risk for suicide. Overwhelmingly, the risk demographically are middle-aged and older men.
Mm-hmm. And middle-aged and older men and younger men are frequently not typically wanting and able to talk about their feelings. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, it's really awful, the messaging that we send to our men about not showing ostensibly what is labeled as weakness, not asking for help. That men, so for example, often the way depression manifests in men looks different from what we might imagine depression would look like. Most of us, when we imagine depression, we think of someone who's crying, who's sad, who can't get out of bed, who's withdrawn. Well, with men, often the way depression manifests is in anger and irritability and
right.
recklessness and road rage and substance use. And so we don't recognize that that's depression. We don't see that behavior and identify it as depression. And so women attempt suicide, women and girls attempt suicide 3 to 4 times as frequently as men do, but men die by suicide 3 to 4 times as frequently as women do. And so it's just a horrible, horrible tragedy that the boys and men in our country either can't or won't access the support that can help them.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've got only, I mean, I could continue and would love to continue this conversation for another hour, but we've got a couple of minutes. So in terms of education, I mean, you are an educator, you educate people around the world. What should we be doing that would help, you know, in some significant way to make people, you know, more aware of the risks for suicide, the warning signs, treatment, you know, availability? What should we be doing that we are not doing right now as a society here, let's just say here in the United States?
So the first thing I would encourage every single one of your listeners to do right now is to put into their phones the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255. That number is not only for people who are themselves at risk of suicide, that number is for family members and friends and anyone who's worried not only about themselves but about someone else. So that even if all else fails and you don't know what else to do, pick up the phone and call that number, and you will be connected with someone who is trained to help you brainstorm how to handle any situation and refer you to resources. So if there's no other takeaway, that phone number is critically important. The other takeaway is to, and interestingly, the pandemic has provided an opportunity to normalize that psychological pain is not rare and is nothing to be ashamed of. And whether you label it depression or anxiety, or whether you just identify it as human beings go through times in their life that are really challenging and sometimes feel overwhelming, and normalize an open discussion about that vulnerability rather than the pressure so many of us feel to put on a brave face, to be perfectionists, to right. not admit that things are difficult. The more we are able to normalize an open discussion, not necessarily labeling it mental health or mental illness, but just that there are times in life that we are, all of us, in pain, that will go a long way. There is no magic formula, any more than there's a magic formula to prevent everyone from having a heart attack, or to prevent everyone from having from getting cancer. There's no way, there's no guarantee, there's no magic formula to prevent every suicide. But what we can do, you're asking a question sort of at a societal level, what we can do, we can know how to get help when we think help is necessary, and we can make it safe to talk about it.
Right. Joanne, this has been an incredibly important conversation. And my last question is, how can people reach you? You know, the show is going to be in the Progressive Radio Network archives, the entire show. So people will be able to listen to it and, you know, get some of the contact information. But the best way to reach Joanne Harpel is what? Where can they reach
you? The best place is my website, which is copingaftersuicide.com. Copingaftersuicide.com.
Great. Well, listen, Joanne, thank you so, so much for coming on the show, for your wisdom. And I look forward to meeting you and continuing the conversation. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks. Take care. Well, everybody, that was Joanne Harpel, clearly an expert, an educator, somebody who's had an enormous amount of experience, both personal and professional, in dealing with this very, very real issue, which is suicide. Well, I can't believe that an hour really has come and gone. I could have continued talking with Joanne for quite some time, and I want to thank you all so much for listening. I hope that today has been helpful to you. I hope that, of course, that you and your family and friends are not suicidal, but if you are, I do hope that I've given you all permission over the years to reach out and ask for help. And again, that suicide hotline number is 800-273-8255. So I leave you with my weekly messages. And the first one is, of course, to do everything that you can possibly do in your life to love yourself. And of course, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other. And my theme song every week as we end the Ask Beattie Show is, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. So goodbye, everybody. Talk with you next week. Be safe. Love each other. Love yourself. Bye-bye.